Hello, I'm Joe Cordell of the domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell. At Cordell & Cordell, we encourage our clients to participate, to recognize how essential their role in this process is. They've got to be willing to help us help them. And by working jointly in a sort of partnership, we're more likely to get the best possible outcome for our clients. And that's really the standard that our clients can fairly hold us to, is what is the best possible outcome for them. So clients who are facing divorce need to recognize that for them to succeed, they need a partnership between them and their attorney.
The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives. Contact the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell to schedule an appointment with one of our firm's San Francisco area attorneys, a partner men can count on. 650-389-1111. Online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com. Offices in San Francisco, San Mateo, and San Jose. Se habla español. Legal services available in English and Spanish. Kimberly Llewellyn, licensed in California.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rassan, today we have founding father of Bitter Culture.
I didn't know you were referring to me. You are referring to me.
I am. That's Sherrod Kooten.
Always a pleasure.
Uh-huh. And we have the return of curator and once upon a time a marketing person.
Yes, that's right.
Ong Jolin.
Good to see you again, Cam.
Or it's not Jolin Ong, is it?
It's Ong Jolin.
Ong Jolin, yeah.
Intentionally
you,
so.
Right, you don't do the Orang Putih style.
No.
Okay.
Never.
And our three topics this week are, topic number one is urban renewal. Topic number two is a career change.
Mm-hmm.
And topic number three is Fleetwood Mac's rumors. So, topic number one, Sherrod, urban renewal.
So, I recently was in Ho Chi Minh City, and so was Jolin,
yes,
by the way.
Right.
But we missed each other like ships passing in the night. And I stayed in a part of Ho Chi Minh City called District 7. And the part I stayed in District 7 is kind of Koreatown. And it was built by the Koreans. It looks, I don't know if it looks like South Korea, but it was all very nice. And it was very un-Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
No street life, you know, everything's indoors. And a lot of the food that you get is kind of like Korean or European, a full European.
The Korean-European cafe
thing.
Model.
Okay. But having traveled right around the city to District 1, which is a tourist district, and seeing all this urban renewal, I was just shocked by, and I kept saying, and I was tweeting out, said, will they keep their architectural heritage? I mean, and some of it's not because they're great buildings, but just the way things are laid out in old Saigon stroke Ho Chi Minh City, mm-hmm, made me think, wow, they're so pretty, it's so interesting. But I also understand that, you know, old buildings creak, to have things that don't work. And so I guess the question I was asking myself is, what should cities strive to keep, and what should they be encouraged to throw away, you know, and replace with very nice things? In fact, parts of Saigon look like Singapore.
I think the mayor intended that. He had actually announced it, that we will be Singapore.
Like, did he?
Yes, it's official.
Oh, but I didn't know that. But yeah. I was just struck by the similarities, meaning it was tropical, it was modern, mm-hmm, it was very, very clean. And the only thing that wasn't Singapore was the chaotic traffic and the fact that people still don't quite, I mean, about 2% don't quite want to follow rules, traffic rules.
But the old, as you were saying, I've been to Hanoi up north. I've never been to Ho Chi Minh City. The old is what, French style architecture?
It's a little bit of that, but it's also just your kind of post-war modern architecture, you know, kind of international style.
Yeah.
You have a mix. It's eclectic. There's no one thing that dominates, I think. The new architecture, the steel and glass, the big buildings, the iconic buildings, they have a big thing that looks like a shard. It looks to me like a shard of glass, but in fact, apparently, is modeled on lotus. So, the lotus being the national flower of Vietnam. So, there is that iconic building in the city that's basically glass and steel.
It's kind of like our Puchot Robong Menara TM.
Ah, that's right. That's right in the style of. Yeah.
You mentioned Singapore and their urban renewal, which is kind of like it's sort of happened already now. It's sort of done, or it's a little bit ongoing. I remember when they redid what was called Chinatown. They kind of kicked everybody out. They did up the building so they're all now beautifully preserved. But the street life, the life that was once there, just evaporated overnight. When I used to stay there, it was just a dead zone. Mm-hmm. And So this is one of the dangers of, you know...
That is a real danger, though I don't know if that's something that's going to... the street life, that is, going to disappear from Ho Chi Minh stroke Saigon. Because it is there. In fact, parts of District 7 that I stayed in are very Vietnamese in the sense that you have the little chairs and tables and people come out in the evenings and they drink and they eat on the streets. And the street food is so fabulous. And a lot of the places are very unpretentious, including little kind of innovations, artists getting together to use their studio as a bar the evening.
The Sao La Collective and Kuru Bar.
Calm down. We're just gushing about...
Worth gushing about.
But if we look at another example, then Georgetown, Penang, where not so very long ago, Georgetown was... decaying, and it was given over to gangsters, and it was dark and a mess. Now it's...
Really?
Once upon a time. But now it is World Heritage Site, lots of boutique hotels, but...
Lots of lighting.
I think this is what people are griping about, even in mainstream media. It's sort of in popular discourse already, like, you know, gentrification and pushing out, like, original inhabitants of a space.
But that goes hand in hand with when the real estate becomes expensive.
And not only that, but there's also efforts at preservation, at upgrading, at making the lives of people much better who are living and couldn't afford to stay in those parts of the city. So, I mean, I'm not against gentrification. I know it's got a kind of negative connotation these days, but in fact, it's about the way in cities renew themselves. And of course, we think Saigon was always what it is, as it were, you know, but it wasn't. It was always evolving. And I think what's interesting about Georgetown as an example is that when you try to describe its architecture, well, you know, the only thing they came up with was Straits Eclectic, which is to say, well, everything and anything that was there over time, you know, that whatever fashion swept through Georgetown from around the world is part of that architectural heritage. And so Saigon, too, has this real mix, you know. But and what I'm saying is that you fear that some really nice things are going to go. And when you sit in the city and sitting at this a microbrewery called East West and, you know, having a beer and it's around the corner from the Mariamman Temple, which is across the street from this chocolatier. You know, you look at some of the buildings, you think, wow, that's a really nice balcony. You know, by the way, the Vietnamese, Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh, love their balconies, love putting plants on top of roofs, on balconies, and it's so nice.
Okay,
We're getting very excited.
It's nice. Clearly you like it. But are buildings without people worth preserving?
Well, no.
Singapore.
I mean, there's people and then there's the idea of when cities renew and regenerate, it really is about income. Like the lower income just gets pushed further and further to the margins, right? Like metaphorically speaking and literally speaking. It's happening at that Razak Mansion thing that's going on too.
And I think cities around the world have had trouble, you know, legislating against that. So, for instance, in KL, you have Kampung Bahru, which really has its own particular identity, which I think is a shifting identity over the decades. But if the zoning is changed, you lose not only Kampung Bahru, but you also lose a place where people can live relatively cheaply right in the heart of town.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I think smart mayors and smart cities figure this out, right? So they Jokowi was smart. I mean, in Solo. But I mean, look, I'm just saying that if you're smart about it, you can make sure balance of forces, right? So the market obviously imposes itself, but the government can come in and create zones where, you know, say for instance, there's always this talk about Berlin. And I've never been to Berlin, but it became a hub for artists because prices were very low, rentals were very low,
and
so
down.
You know, you can think about that. I mean, you can encourage, you know, people through particular policies to have a mixed population.
Yeah, but we tend to resign to the capitalist framework that we refer to, and then what happens
resistance
after
is
the
not
artist,
possible
after the artists come in, then it becomes attractive to people who want to consume culture, and then the prices go up, and the artists can't afford to live there anymore.
Well, okay, they can sell their art and live in big mansions.
All right,
we'll see. So we'll see what happens with Saigon / Ho Chi Minh City, but at the moment, it's a good time to go.
Absolutely. The food is fabulous. I tweeted out, if you follow me on Twitter, you would have gotten a list produced by the Art Center.
Yes, Zero Station.
Zero Station produced a list of must-go-to restaurants. I had like Vietnamese escargot.
Okay.
We're
getting a bit of Saigon, Vietnam mass hysteria in this room here. So look, calm everybody down. And we move on to topic number two, Jolene.
Yes.
Which I would like to call A New Career in a New Town, partly because that's a magnificent David Bowie track.
I didn't agree to that, just for the record.
All right. But change of career.
Yes, so I am what I'd like to call a later in life curator. So here my age becomes evident. What do you
mean? Be proud. Be proud of it.
I'm still the youngest in the room, ha. Huh? Okay.
But once upon a time, not so very long ago, you're in marketing.
Right. So here's the trajectory of my career. So the standard marketing business admin degree program I went to, and then came out, did the usual jobs in F&B and then a legal recruitment firm. Made a lot of, okay, maybe not a lot, but relatively compared to what I'm making now, that was a lot of moolah. And then somehow something just felt amiss. And there was also, you know, coming from a kind of a between middle class and working class family, I felt the need to travel. And typically still haven't begun my process of decolonization yet. I went to Europe and all the great grandmasters' museums.
But yeah. what was going through your mind? Because, you know, sure, we've all had different, not necessarily careers, but different work over the years.
Yeah, and trajectories that were complicated and checkered.
But I'm interested in, you know, the moment, the thought process when it was decision was made to stop doing one thing and do something completely different. Because I think, you know, a lot of people out there in Radio Land go through the same experience.
It took several years. So what happened after I had quit that working was all that traveling and to be able to indulge in art, which had always been a hobby, you know, at the time.
This is very interesting because the turning point often is on things like hobbies. People who make cupcakes and like to play around in a kitchen and cook think, why can't I take something that I really love doing? And
the amateur becomes a professional.
That's right. It's true, you know, and it's true for a lot of people.
I'll embrace amateurism.
I mean, I hear that, you know, this artisan culture has become really big in different places like Singapore. In a discussion I had in Ho Chi Minh City, saying that, you know, lawyers are turning to becoming shoemakers and, you know, because they're charging appropriate prices.
There is a commitment to learning that you have to sort of put into going through that change, right? Because there you are already sort of 30 years old and you're new. So you just, your learning curve is like, in, you know, really steep. So, yeah, but did you commit to learning.
But did you find yourself, I mean, in your previous life, were you thinking, oh, there's something, I was meant to do something else?
In my previous life, I wanted Prada shoes. I still want them though.
But so you...
But now you can't afford them.
Yeah, and I have a conscience.
It's just, I mean, I did say, for myself, you know, new career in a new town. You were in KL, you're still in KL.
Yes, I'm from Ipoh originally, but since I was 18, I've been in KL. Okay. So, yeah.
So what if, as happens with so many Malaysians, where Malaysians, we are constantly exporting people. So is it possible that for any of us to take a leap? Can you imagine taking a leap, new career in a new town, going somewhere else? I know, Sharad, you spent your growing up years in Singapore.
And I did indeed.
And he walked back to Malaysia.
I did, literally.
In your mid-20s.
Late 20s, yeah.
So when you were in Singapore, you were assuming you were going to stay there forever.
I did assume that, but I hadn't really landed on a career in the way that, say, Jolene might have thought that she had a, you know, a full-on career. There was a trajectory, possibly expectations, both self and from others. But what I find fascinating about people who really take on new types of careers, real shifting of the tracks, is that it requires kind of courage.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever been in a situation, I've just gone from one job to another and fallen into things, but I've never been like on a solid trajectory and then thought, you know, I'm going to change. I'm going to give it up. I'm going to make a sacrifice in order to achieve something very different in terms of outcomes. And that, I think, is the interesting thing.
Because I met a guy the other day, older than me, Malaysian fella. He used to be something in advertising here, very, very well known, made a lot of money. He is now a security guard in Perth.
No way.
Yeah. And he is so happy. Yeah. He is so happy. He earns a hell of a lot less. He has absolutely no responsibilities, but he loves it.
I think there's several type of changes that I want to note here. And mine is really not so much a change as I didn't have the privilege of knowledge of certain things, right? I think knowledge, especially in this parts of the world, is very much a privilege. Like the humanities and social sciences, it's not a given in schools. You somehow have to go out and find it. And if you're not of a certain circle, you're just not amongst these academics or people who, you know, cultured literatis discussing these things. And so it took me at 30 years or 26 years old at, you know, museums in Europe and then coming back at the intersection of civil society movements and the arts. And that's when I had a bit of a, if you want to call it, enlightening.
You had an epiphany. But, you know, the more you tell your story, I'm thinking, well, actually you made a move very early in life. I'm not quite sure if 26 was really deep into your life. You know, so I'm thinking, honestly, yeah. This sounds like somebody who
I agree, actually.
You had maybe a four-year stint in advertising marketing and then moved to something like arts. I mean, honestly, if you had made that career change at 40, now that would have been something.
Yeah.
That,
yes.
I mean, next not to guest. Take anything away from you, Jolene, but really, and now think about it, you were far too young. You hadn't really, you just wet your feet. You just wet your feet and your Prada shoes.
Oh, my God.
And you didn't really have...
But my peers are born in 1990, so I'm about to embark in this like curatorial program for like emerging curators, and I'm in 81, and my colleagues are born in 1991. I am old.
1981.
I just announced that.
Full memories.
Well, no, yeah,
we had like relationships and whatnot.
No, I was in secondary two in 1981.
Yeah, so like, okay,
you know.
Actually, now that
Anita Ward had only just had her big hit.
We're going to move on, but Jolene,
yes,
do you see yourself making another one, Career Choice, at some future date?
No.
This is it. You've decided now. Yeah. You are a curator.
In the arts. I'm going to be an arts practitioner, whether I'm sort of lecturing or still making exhibitions, which I love.
Okay. All right. Sharad, what about you, Sharad?
I'm going to stick with radio, I think, for the time being, and with BFM in particular, and talk radio. I think I found my thing very late in life, but I enjoy it too much.
Right. I see a loyalty bonus coming.
I hope,
Malik, are you listening to this?
I think for me, I don't necessarily see a new career, but I could see a new town. So,
Malik, are you also listening to this?
Well, I don't think that's going to... Anyway, in a moment, though, we're going to do topic number three here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Sharad Kutan, and Ong Jolene. And now, topic number three, Fleetwood Mac's rumours. So Fleetwood Mac is a band, originally from Britain in the 1960s, a rhythm and blues band, and they went through many permutations until in the 1970s they settled on their famous lineup, which is five people, three of whom are songwriters, and there were two couples in there. The maths you're going to have to juggle in your head, folks. And then they released their album Rumours in 1977, and it was one of the biggest selling albums of all time. What I would like to talk about was the fact that during the recording of that, and it's a great album, it's a mainstay of what was called adult-oriented rock, AOR. So it's very catchy tunes, but there's a lot of darkness in there as well. In the recording of that, the two couples were in the process of breaking up.
Oh.
So you had keyboardist and songwriter Christine McVie. She's singing a song saying, "Ooh, you make loving fun," but she's not singing about her husband. And he's right there, and he's playing the bass guitar. You have Lindsey Buckingham. Lindsey is a boy's name. Mm-hmm. Lindsey Buckingham singing "Shacking Up Is All You Want to Do," and "I'm Never Going Back." He's singing about his wife, I think, or girlfriend.
Long-term partner.
Stevie Nicks. Yeah. And she's right there, and she's singing beautiful harmonies. She would be singing a song about a Gold Dust Woman, and it's a biting, horrible song about it's a great song, but about a woman who's actually her best friend who is sleeping with her husband, and her husband, Lindsey Buckingham, is right there playing beautiful mandolin. So,
adulting done right, huh?
Yeah. So it was, these were relationships were breaking up, but the creative work was magnificent. It's easily their best album. Their other albums are not bad, but they're very thin by comparison. And I'm wondering if tension and anguish is a necessary or a useful emotion to have swirling around when creating work, not just creative work, but just, you know, office work in general. Do we do better when we have anguish around?
Do you want a short answer or long answer to that?
Well, go ahead.
I say no, it's not good, especially when the work is not creative. Then I think that's actually disenabling.
I want to say that we shouldn't romanticize pain and have this stereotype of artist in anguish, but rather that pain is a part of life, and when you sort of really connect to and engage with your surroundings, and that's very generative for artistic practices, I think.
Okay, well, we look at that, take it outside of the arts world. You have Donald J. Trump, who, you know, obviously we're all fans of here. Uh-huh. We're all on the Trump.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're all on the Trump train.
New convert.
Right.
Too.
So he likes to mix it up, apparently, and he likes his lieutenants to fight against each other and compete for his attention, which is pretty short.
I've had bosses do that to me too.
Yeah, and I think we've all been in a situation like that. And I'm wondering if, you know, does it work? Does it work?
That's how you maintain power. If you look at a higher structure, like in maybe nations, people do that.
Okay, so that's good for you to be the top dog, but is it good for
the
objectives
dog?
That you set out for this team to do, which is to come up with good policy or to come up with good songs or whatever, you know? So I don't know. I think in an office situation, I would think it's a very bad policy.
It's vile.
Toxic. But
toxic.
In the creative world, if you're looking at collective type endeavors, like a band or something, maybe if the stuff is connected to the drama. So you need a bit of drama, and the drama that you have in the group, you know, feeds it.
But that's life, no? There's always a bit of drama in everyone's life.
Did at any point in that story about Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham and all these people, did they just say, I don't want to work with you? And I'd rather storm out of this room than to continue working with somebody who's betrayed me? Or
yeah, that's a funny thing. I think that they all realized that they were creatively onto something good here, that they could work together and create really wonderful sounds, really wonderful music, that, you know, they'd worked with many different people over the years, but now they had songwriting partners with whom they could really make something happen.
Sometimes we project our dramas on what we see. I mean I'm not trying to use them as an example. I think they were quite clearly trying to do something monogamous, but yeah, maybe we look at a couple and it's like maybe they're kind of open and it's not as dramatic as we think it is.
Yeah, so that's what my thinking is, that in fact the pain wasn't that great. Because if you were betrayed by somebody, you would be so choked up and bitter unless you had some time. Or it couldn't have meant that much to you. It really couldn't have. I mean, that's my thinking. I mean, if I was in the room with somebody who had betrayed me, I would...
You'd go. That's it. Done.
Yeah,
Or I would use them to my advantage and have a hit record. Why not?
Yeah, maybe. But there's something about the collaborative musical thing that I know nothing about music,
which
I think doesn't lend itself to being, you know, sitting in the room and talking with people you don't like.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not a musician.
Okay.
But I think I would.
All right. Well, here's another thing. Jolene, you said earlier about, you know, the romance of anguish. We think of Vincent van Gogh and cutting off his ear.
Good Lord.
And he is the absolute archetype of the tortured artist. And am I, in a way, fascinated more by the story than by the music itself? I think I love the album anyway.
I was just going to say that in the case of, like, Stevie Nicks and Fleetwood Mac, their drama didn't overtake the music. I mean, they're that good, right? That album anyway, I think. And as for archetype, I think it's more stock character. And I kind of, like, detest stock characters. Tortured artist, manic pixie, dream girl.
Yeah. So now you're a curator and you're working with artists.
Yes.
Do you meet young artists who feel it necessary to inhabit that character? Do they want to be the stereotype?
Of course not. Who wants to be the stereotype? But I think some practices come across as disingenuous. But the good ones really are just like connecting to a deeper place in their life or truly trying to communicate something, right? So the notion of curator or artist as an interlocutor. So if you think about that story by Jhumpa Lahiri, the taxi driver being the interpreter of melodies, right? So, yeah.
You've lost me there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Taxi driver, take me to the interpreter of melodies.
No. I mean, I think the point really at this is, I mean, there are people who are posers, right? And for whom the tortured artist is something they inhabit because they find it comforting and they think then people will recognize them to be the artist that they want to be, right?
I would count myself fortunate as haven't quite encountered
The question is, who told the story about Fleetwood Mac? I mean, was it one of them recounting the story and saying this was actually what was happening in the studio at that time?
It was,
or was it something someone else discovered?
I think it was legend even as it was happening. I mean, they had a Rolling Stone cover at that time, which was like, I think it was, the title was The Most Incestuous Band, and there was a photograph of them all in bed, and it was, they talked about the story.
So they played it up too.
Yeah, they played it up. Yeah. So that's my suspicion. I mean, because I think if you truly were hurt mortally by somebody.
But the point is,
they weren't hurt mortally. I mean, yeah.
Maybe they were already hurt mortally. But, and then here comes the silver lining. Take it in your stride.
Yeah, they worked with it. The point is they worked with it. And okay. All right. So, Sharad, you like a nice placid workspace.
Jolene, no,
Yeah.
I will use my pain.
Yeah, you'll use your pain. Me, I'm self-employed. I work on my own. So I guess I don't want to be too tortured. Don't want to get too angry with myself. Right. Well, anyway, it's a wonderful album. At the end of the show, we're going to play out with one of the songs, which I'll introduce.
Not Anita Ward's Ring My Bell?
Actually, no. No. I think not, no.
I'm so tempted to sing.
Right. So now, though, we come to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Sharad's going to go first.
Okay, the War Remnants Museum in Ho Chi Minh City. Unlike the wonderful food and the uplifting architecture and all the prospects and aspirations that young Vietnamese have for the future, the War Remnants Museum is a reminder of the past. And it's very heavy. I mean, it is so heavy when you go through it. It's, oddly enough, huge numbers of tourists go through it.
Yes.
There's an incredible exhibition of photographers that lost their lives during the Vietnam War. Singaporeans. Three Singaporeans, a range of other people. Their pictures are there. The pictures they took are there. And a whole range of things, including a segment on Agent Orange. But really heavy, but a must-see. I think you can't go without seeing that.
I went to the military museum up in Hanoi. It was fascinating as well. A bit run down. But what I found interesting with that was that there were busloads of Chinese tourists coming. And Vietnam fought a short, bloody and successful war against China in, I think, 1978. And there was just one photograph mentioning that. Otherwise, there was no mention of that war.
Yeah, after the war with America, they did have quite a terrible war with China for a couple of years. But I actually went there and I was shocked that people... Because it's not a badly run museum. It's odd in the way things are curated. And there's some kitsch available in the corridors. And they cut, put your face to a cutter with like happy, smiley people.
Really?
Mm. Yeah, I took pictures of that and I tweeted it out. Actually, I was real distressed by this museum that I actually tweeted a lot out. Well, you know,
it was quite a tweet storm then. Your
it was. And this is why you should follow me at Sharad Kutum.
Okay, so the recommendation is follow Sharad on Twitter, but also go to the
War Remnants Museum in Ho Chi Minh City.
Okay. Jolene, your recommendation.
Well, I want to show off that I was in Saigon too, so I'm going to recommend go to Saula Collective's Kuru Bar, which we talked about earlier. Yeah. You can find them on
Do they allow non-artists?
Oh, yes, of course.
Kuru is spelled C-U-R-U?
Yes, C-U-R-U.
What's
the
accent?
And beware, be warned, it's on the fourth floor, so there are like five flights of stairs.
And the entrance is completely dark.
Yeah.
And so you feel like you're going through down a terrible alley.
Don't leave too drunk, is all I can say.
So what's
And try the fish sauce chili pepper cocktail.
Oh,
there.
They make the most amazing cocktails.
God, you
and
too.
There, and there you can like sit and think whether you want to use pain or walk away from it in your work, or whether you want to have a life career switch. It's perfect.
And lots of art up these wonderful old staircases, all very dilapidated.
All right. Producer Ali, can you stop them now, please? All right. So to go to the Kuru Bar in
Saigon.
And it's a bar, but it's like really happening, is it?
Yeah, and downstairs there's a studio, artist studio.
All right, cool.
Okay. And your recommendation?
I'm going to really cheat on this one. I'm going to recommend Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. It's
what?
I know. It's just that I've been listening to it on constant rotation for the last few months. It's a great album, 1977, really catchy tunes, but also darkness. And when you do think of the story that I've told you, I think it really does sort of fill it out more.
Yeah. I think there are a couple of interviews that Stevie Nicks gave later in life about this drama as well.
Yeah.
And just to prove I'm not that young, just so the younger listeners know, Dreams was not an original by The Corrs, and Landslide was not an original by Dixie Chicks. Thank you.
Okay, okay. So, yes, young kids out there, ask your grandparents. They might remember it, along with the Japanese occupation and tuberculosis. And it's a wonderful album. And we're going to play out, actually, with one of their tracks. Producer Ali has said we can. It's a song by Christine McVie called Songbird. And it's just her on the piano. It was recorded in an empty auditorium in San Francisco. It had to be, as when you hear the song, it had to be recorded in one take. So it was just her on the stage with a single spotlight, a glass of champagne and a rose, and she had to sing it through. She finally got it done, and it's absolute perfection. And so we're going to play it with Songbird. But before we go, I must say our thanks to a special honored guest, Ong Jolin.
You're welcome.
And stick with that career. And Sharad Kutan.
Always a pleasure.
Who's going to stick to his career.
I will indeed.
Myself, Cam Ruslan. If you'd like to get in touch with us, I think Sharad's on Twitter.
I am indeed. In fact, I've mentioned it about three times now. And for the third time, at Sharad Kutan, spelled S-H-A-R-A-D-K-T-T-T-N.
Yeah, and Ong Jolin, is she?
Ong Jolin is on Instagram, visual curator.
Oh, cool.
Oh, and you can find Kuruba on Instagram, you said earlier, didn't you? Okay, right. I'm going to do that too.
And you can check us out on A Bit of Culture on our Facebook page. Please press like. And if you do press like, then Ong Jolin gets to keep her career. otherwise, sorry, Jolene, the people have voted.
I'll just wallow in my pain then.
And please join us next week for another exciting A Bit of Culture as we play out with Fleetwood Mac's Songbird here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, I'm Joe Cordell of the domestic litigation firm Cordell & Cordell. At Cordell & Cordell, we encourage our clients to participate, to recognize how essential their role in this process is. They've got to be willing to help us help them. And by working jointly in a sort of partnership, we're more likely to get the best possible outcome for our clients. And that's really the standard that our clients can fairly hold us to, is what is the best possible outcome for them. So clients who are facing divorce need to recognize that for them to succeed, they need a partnership between them and their attorney.
The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives. Contact the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell to schedule an appointment with one of our firm's San Francisco area attorneys, a partner men can count on. 650-389-1111. Online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com. Offices in San Francisco, San Mateo, and San Jose. Se habla español. Legal services available in English and Spanish. Kimberly Llewellyn, licensed in California.